From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now, a case that could fundamentally alter a person's right to an abortion in the United States went before the Supreme Court today. Advocates for abortion rights are challenging a law in Mississippi that bans the procedure after 15 weeks. And hanging in the balance is the future of the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which protected the right to an abortion. Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart argued before the court today that the question should be left up to the states.
Abortion is a hard issue. It demands the best from all of us, not a judgment by just a few of us. When an issue affects everyone, and when the Constitution does not take sides on it, it belongs to the people.
NPR's Sarah McCammon has been following this case, and she joins us now. Sarah, tell me more about the state's argument here and how the justices responded.
So the state of Mississippi is not simply asking the court to uphold this law banning abortion after 15 weeks. They're asking the court to overturn Roe v. Wade altogether. And as we heard, the argument from Mississippi was that the Constitution doesn't speak to the legality of abortion. And so they say the court should overturn Roe, which says that women do have that right, at least up until a fetus is viable. Now, Justice Brett Kavanaugh seemed amenable to that idea, as did others, at least from reading between the lines of some of the questions. Kavanaugh suggested that Mississippi was asking the state to be, quote, scrupulously neutral on abortion and allow states to decide whether and how much to restrict it. Meanwhile, Justice Sonia Sotomayor raised questions about the decision to take this case at all and the potential implications of it. She said the court risked looking very political if it upholds this law, given that it contradicts decades of precedent. And she said, quote, will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
The Mississippi Clinic at the center of this case, it's now the last place you can get an abortion in the state. The clinic's lawyer, Julie Rickelman, told the court that 15 weeks is not enough. Let's listen.
People who need abortion after 15 weeks are often in the most challenging circumstances. As I mentioned, there are people who have perhaps had a major health or life change, a family illness, a job loss, a separation, young people or people who are on contraception or pregnant for the first time and who are delayed in recognizing the signs of pregnancy.
She also said that poor women who don't have access to health care often will try to get an abortion after 15 weeks. How did the question of timing play out in the argument today?
Yeah, Chief Justice John Roberts spent a lot of time talking about timing and that viability standard. He asked why viability should be where the line is drawn as opposed to 15 weeks, as is in this law. And Roberts suggested that there's not much difference between 15 weeks and viability. He said it's, quote, not a dramatic departure from viability. Now, I would just note viability is right around 24 weeks, so that's about a 9-week difference. Many women get a standard ultrasound right around 20 weeks, so there are fetal anomalies that may not be diagnosed yet at the 15-week stage. And for a host of reasons, as we've heard, some people just aren't able to get an abortion at earlier stages. But Roberts appeared with his questions to be exploring whether or not there might be a way for the court to uphold the Mississippi law, thereby reversing major Supreme Court precedent, but still carve out some space for some abortions to be permitted earlier in pregnancy.
Sarah, the court is considerably more conservative now compared to the last time it considered Roe v. Wade. How do you think that might influence the outcome in this case? And did you hear anything today about how they might rule?
Right. This court is much more conservative. A third of the court was chosen by former President Trump, who, of course, promised while campaigning to choose justices who would overturn Roe. And as we've heard, the conservative justices seemed very friendly to the arguments coming from Mississippi. And just the decision to take this case at all, to consider a law clearly at odds with existing precedent, very likely tells us a lot about the disposition of the conservative justices on this issue. They are in the majority, and all of them have at least some record of opposing abortion rights. And also remember that the justices have allowed a Texas law banning abortion around 6 weeks to remain in effect since September. So they, at minimum, have seen no urgency to block that even more restrictive law.
And just briefly, when will we know for sure?
There's a decision expected next summer, and whatever is decided, people will be closely watching how it's written.
All right. NPR National Desk correspondent Sarah McCammon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For more, let's bring in Michelle Oberman. She's a law professor at Santa Clara University and author of the 2018 book, Her Body, Our Laws. Professor, what stood out to you in the arguments this morning?
What I thought was most interesting was Justice Roberts' questions that suggested an interest in trying to find a compromised position of hanging on to the 15 weeks as a cutoff. And the reason why I thought that was most interesting is because it's indefensible and was quickly revealed as such by arguments on both sides. And honestly, there's no stopping point. So if you set it at 15 weeks, there's no reason why other states wouldn't quickly come in with laws that suggested 9 weeks or 6 weeks or conception.
Interesting. So let's go with a scenario then in which the Mississippi law is upheld and it is a sweeping enough decision that it effectively overturns Roe and Casey. What do you see happening next? How immediately would access to abortion change in Mississippi and elsewhere?
So let's start by observing that access to abortion is already fairly limited in states like Mississippi and in, you know, throughout much of the southeastern United States. There are not a lot of places where one can go to terminate a pregnancy. But what the immediate effect is that then there's the imposition of the risk of criminal liability on the woman who's pregnant and on anybody who assists her. So very quickly, what we end up with is a completely stratified system where those with money are going to be able to travel to the states where it remains legal to end a pregnancy. And those who don't have the funds are going to be forced into continuing pregnancy or forced into resorting to online abortion medications and ending pregnancies on their own, possibly risking prosecution.
I mean, to your point about the limited access in Mississippi, as an example, there's only one clinic that provides abortion services there. Do you think that if the Mississippi law is upheld, that clinic would be able to stay in business?
I don't imagine that it would have to close for the duration of the time that 15 weeks remains the standard. I think it would be just a matter of time until the clinic ended up closing because the law ended up moving the line back from 15 weeks. When you talk to folks who are truly opposed to abortion, you quickly realize that they're opposed to not just abortion, but to many contraceptions that they believe would somehow interfere with the development of life. And so it's not just that they're coming for an abortion at 15 weeks, they're coming for contraception.
And presumably opposed to pills, for example, that could induce an abortion as well. Would you see that as a viable option going forward, or do you see a threat to that as well?
Well, so yeah, I mean, what's interesting about the world of abortion medications is what we can learn from countries around the world where abortion is illegal, which is that they're widely used and quite effectively to end unwanted pregnancies, and that the law has been unable to figure out a way of curtailing the supply of those drugs or of prosecuting those who use those drugs. I mean, misoprostol, which is the, you know, half of the effective ingredients in the abortion pills that we use here, is widely available online. You can buy it for around $2 a pill. There's no way at this point in time to differentiate a miscarriage brought on by the drugs as opposed to a naturally occurring miscarriage. And so what we'll see happening here is the rapid escalation of a market that already is present in this country of folks ordering drugs online and ending their pregnancies safely at home that way.
And Professor, we know that people all over the country, not just in Mississippi, are watching this case closely. In fact, a dozen states have moved to automatically ban abortion if Roe is overturned without even having to call a special legislative session. So how do you see both sides of the abortion debate gearing up for whatever comes next?
The first thing that'll happen, I think, for folks who are newly emboldened abortion opponents is that they'll immediately start trying to figure out ways to enforce their laws on the assumption that making abortion illegal matters in some practical way. I think what's going to be interesting is how they respond to the fact that abortion rates don't drop and that the laws are so hard to enforce. I think on the other side, the pro-choice advocates will quickly move into an information and access battle that endeavors, I think, to have as many folks as possible understand how to use abortion medications, how to access them safely, how to know how much to take, how to discern how far along you are in your pregnancy. And so that digital battle, which will be, I think, supported by organizations like Women on Web and Plan C, will hopefully avert some of the catastrophes that accompanied illegal abortion prior to Roe v. Wade. So we'll sort of see both sides moving quickly into new spheres of activism. I imagine the fight in the courts will continue, but I think it'll quickly become apparent that abortion is not simply about whether or not it's legal, that that's just one of many, many questions, and that abortion itself doesn't disappear when it becomes illegal.
Michelle Oberman is a professor of law at Santa Clara University. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
नमस्कार दोस्तों, मैं हूं गीता, लेकर आई हूं अपना शो जासूस या जर्नलिस्ट। दोस्तों, एक तरफ तो सरकार महिला सुरक्षा को लेकर के बड़े बड़े वादे करती है।
And that is sound from Khabar Lahariya, or Waves of News. It's India's only women-led news outlet, founded in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. Since its beginning as a newspaper in 2002, Khabar Lahariya has grown. Its YouTube channel has more than 500,000 subscribers, and now it's the focus of a new documentary, Writing with Fire. The Hindi-language film won 2 awards at this year's Sundance Film Festival, and joining me now are the film's directors, Rintu Thomas. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Great to have you. And Sushmit Ghosh, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to this chat.
Well, you know, it's tempting to say that the female journalists in your documentary are fearless, but that's not quite right. They actually have many fears, but they do their work anyway. And I'm wondering if you can describe some of the challenges they face and how they overcome them.
I think that's a brilliant way of putting it, because when we say fearless, it feels like fear is absent. But what's really special about the women at Khabar Lahariya is that despite every odd, they're continuing the good fight. So the region in which they work in is riddled with a lot of risks. It's a state with a very high rate of violence against women and violence against the Dalit community. So they are working on stories that are around corruption, around questioning violence against women. And so these things are not things that sit very comfortably with the powers to be. And so I'd say that every step of the way, it's risky.
Yeah, you mentioned they're members of the Dalit caste, and I don't want to just gloss over that, because folks may be familiar with another description, the untouchables. I mean, this is a compounding factor. It's hard enough for them to do their jobs as women. And then on top of that, they're members of sort of this bottom tier of society, Sushmit. That must really add another layer of difficulty to their jobs.
It does. I think just for brief context, the Hindu scriptures divide society into 4 key castes. And within each caste, there are multiple subcastes. And it's sort of like a pyramid social structure with the academics and the priests right at the top and the working class right at the bottom. And the Dalit community is considered so impure, they have been kept out of the caste system. And this has been a millennia-old practice. So the practice of caste-based discrimination is illegal in India, but you know, it's something that sticks with your skin. How do you get rid of a 3,000-year-old social hierarchy? And Dalit women have historically been some of the most oppressed demographics in India. So to be a Dalit woman journalist in itself is path-breaking, if not, you know, revolutionary in what the women at Khabar Lahariya are doing.
Well, so the opening scene, I think, really captures that dynamic with this powerful sequence in which we see Meera, who is kind of the reporter you feature most in the film. She's the chief reporter for the news outlet, and she's interviewing a woman who has been raped multiple times. And then we watch her follow-up at the police station, where the victim and her husband have both tried to report the crimes and were turned away, ignored. And we hear at one point the victim say something that has stuck with me since watching the film, which is that your news outlet is really my only hope. Essentially, she's just hoping that there will be public outcry from the press. That seems to be the only way for a Dalit woman to get results. At least that's how she feels.
When you're a Dalit woman, violence is not new. And you're expected to bear it and expected to be quiet about it. And also, when it comes to sexual violence, there is this whole idea of shame and honor, which is universal. In this case, I think just the desire to be heard to be acknowledged is what we witness in so many cases that our journalists were reporting. And there was this general mistrust for journalists because it's related to corruption. And so our journalists many, many times are the only people that people would walk up to and trust.
And to your point about the corruption issue, there's a couple of scenes in which the journalists have to explain to folks, hey, I don't want a bribe. You don't have to pay me to tell your story. That's not how we operate. And that seems to catch some people off guard. I want to ask you a little bit more about Mira, though, because she's such a compelling figure. You know, we see her at a time in her life when she's already a very experienced reporter. But then we back up in her life a little bit and we learn that, you know, she was married at 14. She's got three children who she's trying to raise at the same time that she's also doing this very important and risky job. And to boot, she, like some of her colleagues, is married to a guy who's not all that supportive of her career. In fact, we see her husband interviewed on camera briefly and he sort of poo-poos the newspaper and says it's probably not going to survive very long. The traditional expectations on women is a theme that comes up over and over. And it really seems to be an added struggle that they have to overcome.
I think one of the complexities that we wanted to sort of explore through this story was the guilt of a woman where she has to make a choice between taking care of her family or essentially having a successful career, and how that gets even more complicated when you are a Dalit woman and you have to make these choices and the stakes are exceptionally high. And Mira herself is very calm, is someone who's very rooted, but is also thinking about the future and is also very firm. So she has this very interesting dynamic and a way of sort of navigating the world, which we found very compelling and something that had to be presented to the world. There is a certain weight in her presence as a person, and she instinctively drew both Rintu and me to her.
Well, Mira, her compelling nature is undeniable. There's a sequence that really stands out to me. In one scene, we see a news conference where she's putting some really tough questions to a police official. And afterward, a male reporter like takes her aside and tells her she's doing her job wrong. She should have asked easy questions or even flattering questions first. His delivery is totally patronizing. But I noticed that in the next scene, Mira kind of adopts his strategy when she's interviewing the leader of this vigilante group. She begins by remarking that the group is being taken much more seriously than it has in the past. And that seems to kind of get the conversation flowing. And my takeaway was it seems like these journalists, and Mira in particular, have remarkably thick skins, Rintu. I mean, they're able to pick up tips and lessons even from people who don't treat them with respect.
You know, they're such smart negotiators and people who really know how to read a room, and mostly the only people in a space who are most unwelcome. So when that's the circumstance in which you are working, how do you negotiate and how do you navigate the mansplaining, the oppressive nature of patriarchy? So it's really about getting to know the person and creating a space where the person will talk to you.
Yeah, they're remarkably savvy, and they've evolved with the time. So, Shmeet, there's a scene that really resonated with me. Of course, many of the experiences these women have are things I cannot relate to, but there is a scene where they're talking about, we're going digital. This is in 2016. We're going online. We're not just going to be a print newspaper anymore. And I thought, I've sat through these kinds of meetings myself at a newspaper in the late aughts, and it's been a double-edged sword for them, right? We see some of the women really struggling. They don't use smartphones at home, so learning how to use it as a reporting tool in some cases is really challenging, but it's also the thing that has allowed them to reach a much bigger audience than they would have when they set out 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And it was such a smart move because India, after China, has the largest mobile phone penetration in the world, one of the largest mobile phone markets. And as you see in the film, you might not have electricity at home, but you will definitely have a mobile phone connection. And I think that's the wave that the women essentially wanted to ride on. They knew that there was a huge potential to augment the viewership and, more importantly, democratize the viewership, because when they were running a print edition, they were doing roughly 5,000 prints every 2 weeks. The consumers were mostly men, because usually women in these parts would not be lettered. But the moment they shifted to digital, more and more women started consuming the news. And so in that sense, that kind of equalized the ratio of men and women who were consuming the news at Khabar Lehriya. And of course, the kind of newsmaking that they've been doing, the authenticity of their newsmaking, there's a huge reach for it.
Yeah, they're putting up traffic numbers that would be the envy of many much larger, more well-funded news outlets for sure. I have to wonder, though, Rintu, as you were following these journalists around the country, you go with them into some dicey situations. Did you ever worry about their safety? Did you want to intervene at times? Or did you suspect sometimes that maybe things would have gone differently if your cameras hadn't been rolling?
Why the opposite? It's because of them that we got so much access, trust, and we stayed protected. And there were many situations which got tricky. And our way of functioning was we would always tell them, tell us if you'd want us to not join or roll the camera, and we won't. You know, it's one thing to see a violent situation, their phones have been snatched, they get threatening calls to pull down a story and all of that. What we really wanted to communicate through the film is, how do you work in a situation where every day is a risk? Every day you step out of your house, you can be made invisible. How do you show everyday violence without showing a drop of blood? That is really the climate of fear in which they work on an everyday basis, is what we wanted to communicate, because that's when their courage becomes special. You work despite all the odds and you make it look like this is the only option.
Your film captures a period in their reporting pre-pandemic. So, Shmeet, I'm wondering how the last couple of years may have changed things for Kabar Laria and what you think may come next.
Explosive growth is what they have witnessed. So while most of the other mainstream press, which is manned by upper caste men, was sort of hustling and trying to figure out how to manage during the pandemic, these women essentially were already sort of reporting from the ground. So they've witnessed more growth, more traffic on their site, and a bigger team. They're only doing well.
Sounds like you may have material for a sequel.
Absolutely.
That's Sushmeet Ghosh and Rintu Thomas, makers of the new documentary, Writing with Fire. Thanks to both of you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. This was a pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Honduras has chosen a woman to lead the country for the first time in its history. The leftist Xiomara Castro has claimed victory in the presidential election, removing the conservative National Party from power for the first time in 12 years. The results come as a relief to many Hondurans who feared a contested election. In 2017, there were accusations of vote fixing and corruption, followed by protests that left 23 people dead. Journalist Jeff Ernst is in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, covering this story. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The National Party leader conceded the election to Castro. That's something that many Hondurans didn't even think was possible. Well, what's the mood there today?
The mood is one really of relief. You know, in the lead up to elections, you know, businesses were boarding up their windows, people were stocking up on essentials, and there was a lot of fear and anxiety about a repeat of the 2017 election that, due to the extremely close results, led to a post-electoral crisis in which there was widespread destruction and at least 23 people resulted dead. So today, Honduras is in peace, everyone's relieved, and there's also a sense of hope that after 12 years of one-party rule in which the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, and his party have been implicated in really a never-ending saga of drug trafficking and corruption allegations. Mm. There's hope that Honduras can turn the page and a brighter future can come.
The incoming president does have quite a job ahead of her, though. She's in a country that's been devastated by natural disasters, unemployment, street gangs, corruption, migration. Is there optimism that she can fix all of that?
There is optimism that she can put the country back on the right track, strengthen institutions, bring back return respect for the separation of powers, and do all these things that really are at the root of the problems that are hurting the economy, that are causing people to flee. But at the same time, there's a recognition that the challenges are so great that change won't be quick. It will take time, and even during the next 4 years of her term, we won't be able to see a completely new country.
On the issue of migration, how do you expect her to navigate that with President Biden here in the U.S.?
You know, I think both sides recognize that they need each other. The U.S. is Honduras's number one trading partner. The migration from Honduras, it becomes a domestic political issue in the U.S. I think that the Castro will look to cooperate with the U.S., but at the same time ensure that Honduras' sovereignty is respected. How that will play out exactly, it's hard to say.
All right. That's reporter Jeff Ernst reporting from Honduras on the election of Xiomara Castro. And you are hearing a leaf blower outside my window. Sorry about that, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The World Trade Organization has postponed a meeting about waiving patent rights for vaccines because of the rise of the Omicron variant. Some want wealthy countries to loosen their grip on the global vaccine supply and make it easier to manufacture doses in the developing world. So just how much is vaccine inequity hindering efforts to combat the pandemic? Ed Silverman has been reporting on this subject for our partners at the health and medicine publication STAT. And Ed, let's start in Southern Africa, where this Omicron variant was first discovered. How does the vaccination rate there compare to other countries?
So the problem literally is on the ground. Across the African continent, just 6% of the population has been vaccinated. That compares with 58% in the United States and approximately 70% in Canada. So from the start, there was a tremendous amount of supply that was being purchased and stockpiled in the U.S., European countries, where in contrast, nothing really was getting to the poor countries, particularly Africa.
But then there was this COVAX program, right, Ed? Can you refresh us on how that works? This was supposed to funnel vaccines from wealthier countries to developing countries. Based on the figures you're ticking off, it's not working very well on the African continent. So what's the holdup?
Well, last year, in response to this looming problem, the World Health Organization worked with a couple of other entities to create COVAX, which is designed to provide donations to 90 or so low and middle income countries around the world. So you're looking at a situation where the wealthy countries in the world are able to snap up what they can pay for, and poor countries relying on donations that just aren't coming through either quickly enough or in meaningful ways.
So if we step back here, Ed, I mean, as you mentioned, some of these wealthier countries hoarding, stockpiling vaccines, some are arguing the Omicron variant shows that was the wrong approach because leaving large swaths of the world unvaccinated can allow the virus to mutate and spread. But I wonder if it's possible that rich countries will actually reach the opposite conclusion, that Omicron shows they were right to hoard vaccines for booster doses, which are now a key defense against the variant.
Well, the problem with that logic is it belies the underlying truth, which is if a chunk of the world isn't vaccinated in the first place, you're going to have another variant emerge. So it really provides a false sense of security to wealthy nations that can afford to pay whatever they're paying per vaccine dose. It just won't work long enough.
So there's this distribution issue with vaccines, but there's another layer to it too, right, Ed? Because some are calling on the World Trade Organization to step in and just let these poorer countries produce vaccines themselves. How is the WTO responding to those calls? Do you think that's likely to happen?
I think that's unlikely to happen, at least the way it appears right now. South Africa and India a year ago proposed a temporary waiver on intellectual property and know-how. The goal was to let companies in other countries produce COVID vaccines. But right now, the waiver hinges on full agreement at the WTO. You need all 164 member nations to agree. This temporary waiver would make it possible for companies in other countries to retool their facilities, but they can't do that without the vaccine recipes. And those vaccine recipes are intellectual property. They're closely guarded by the vaccine makers. And some of these countries have decided that they're going to oppose this proposal.
But Ed, how much responsibility, though, do those individual companies bear? Right? I mean, there's the policy, but we just saw in the fall, Amnesty International released a very critical report denouncing AstraZeneca, J&J, Moderna, Pfizer, these vaccine makers. They said they were, quote, wheeling and dealing in favor of wealthy states. So should they be doing more, or is it just unreasonable to expect these companies to, you know, act in against their own commercial self-interest?
Well, I started to say some of the countries that are opposing the waiver are home to some of the largest global drug and vaccine makers. And if they can succeed in convincing these countries to oppose the waiver, it won't go forward. And so you've got this very, very complicated, delicate dance going on behind the scenes that's created this enormous tension and this stagnation.
That's Ed Silverman with our partners at Stat News, the health and medicine publication. Ed, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
When it comes to international relations and maintaining peace, is it best to keep things vague or to clarify intentions? The U.S. has managed to keep the peace with Taiwan on vague terms for four decades. But as NPR China Affairs correspondent John Ruwitch reports, there are signs that more clarity could be ahead.
Strategic ambiguity, that's the U.S. approach. Washington, which has no formal ties with Taiwan but is friendly with the island, has never promised to help it fight in the event of a conflict with China. It's also never promised not to step in. David Sachs is a research fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And the calculation behind that was that if China was not sure that we wouldn't come to Taiwan's defense, it would deter a Chinese attack.
Taiwan has been politically separate from the mainland since 1949, when the Communist Party took power in China and the Nationalist Party fled to the island. But Beijing claims it as Chinese territory and hopes to bring it back into the fold eventually, by force if needed. For years, the mere possibility that the U.S. might intervene has given Chinese leaders pause. But Sachs says things have changed.
China has undertaken a massive military modernization, and it's focused above all else on a Taiwan contingency, on developing the capabilities to invade and annex Taiwan and to prevent the United States from coming to Taiwan's defense.
Sachs co-authored a piece in Foreign Affairs last year that got a lot of attention. It laid out the case for abandoning strategic ambiguity in favor of strategic clarity. Not everyone agrees, though, that ditching ambiguity is the right move.
Strategic clarity, in which we say we will defend Taiwan against attack, would surely be the end of any substantial working relationship with China. There's no question about that.
Stephen Goldstein is director of the Taiwan Studies Workshop at Harvard University's Fairbanks Center. He says there's another risk in shifting to clarity.
It's also dangerous in the sense that it could encourage independence elements on Taiwan.
Strategic ambiguity is about dual deterrence, keeping China from invading and preventing Taiwan from moving toward formal independence, a big red line for Beijing. Polls show that most people in Taiwan have a negative view of China, but just a small percentage support moving toward formal independence. George Yin, an international security expert in Taiwan, says some surveys suggest that a clear promise of American military help might change the equation.
If the U.S. pursues strategic clarity, that could actually change the public's level of support for Taiwan's pursuit of de jure independence.
The irony of strategic ambiguity is that for years, successive U.S. administrations have made it work by occasionally sending not-so-ambiguous signals to one side or the other. In the early 2000s, Taiwan's president Chen Shui-bian pushed the envelope on independence. Paul Hanley, who worked on China issues at the National Security Council at the time, says the Bush administration reminded Taiwan that America didn't support either side changing the status quo.
White House envoys were sent to Taipei to tell Chen Shui-bian to kind of cool things down, and he didn't. And I think the relationship really deteriorated.
In recent weeks, President Biden has made some remarks that have deviated from the normal script. In August, he said the U.S. was committed to defending the island in the same way it was committed to defending its NATO allies. And last month, he said America would come to Taiwan's aid in the event of a Chinese attack. The White House clarified that American policy had not changed. Again, George Yin.
My guess is that what President Biden said, they are not mistakes.
Whether or not they actually helped deter Beijing is another question. China's military is stronger than ever, and it has tools that may be able to deny the U.S. a role in a Taiwan conflict, like hypersonic missiles that can hit ships at sea.
I think the administration is under the false impression that if you make China more certain about the U.S. commitment to defend Taiwan, that will change China's calculus.
Oriana Schuyler-Mastro is an expert on China's military and politics at Stanford University.
I think they're primarily in Beijing thinking about, will they succeed? It's an issue of U.S. capabilities, not an issue of U.S. resolve.
And U.S. capabilities, she says, are not the deterrent that they used to be. In war games and simulations in recent years, the American side often loses. John Ruich, NPR News.
Unless you've lived in the Southwest, you may not be familiar with Valley Fever. But here in Arizona and in parts of California, the fungal respiratory disease sickens thousands of people each year. It's even more common in dogs. And now, for the first time, researchers at the University of Arizona say they've found a vaccine that can prevent the illness in pets. And maybe someday humans can use it too. Catherine Davis-Young from KJZZ reports.
Walk into any veterinary clinic in central Arizona and ask about Valley Fever, and you're likely to get a response like this.
At our clinic, I probably would say anywhere from like 2 to 20 cases a month.
That's Scott Hoffman. He's a longtime vet with a clinic in Central Phoenix.
And I would probably say if you would interview other veterinarians, they may actually give you a higher number.
For dogs, Valley Fever can mean coughing, weight loss, even seizures. The illness typically means months of suffering for the dogs and months of veterinary bills for dog owners. Arizona dog owners spend about $60 million on the disease each year, and Hoffman says there's really no way to avoid it.
The number one way you can prevent it, unfortunately, is not live here in Arizona, unfortunately.
Valley Fever comes from a fungus that's found in desert soils. When dogs or humans inhale airborne fungal spores, their lungs and other parts of the body can be infected. It can be a grueling disease, and it's more common in Arizona than anywhere else. But it also shows up in California and other parts of the Southwest.
Valley Fever is considered an orphan disease because nationally, it's a very small problem.
That's Dr. John Galgiani, director of the University of Arizona's Valley Fever Center for Excellence. He and other researchers have spent decades trying to find a vaccine to prevent Valley Fever. But that goal has always been a long shot. Not only does Valley Fever not get the national attention other diseases get, but there's never been a vaccine for a fungal illness in the history of medicine. But Galgiani and his team believe they're onto something.
Well, serendipity plays a role in almost everything like this that occurs.
That's Lisa Schubitz. She's the lead author on a new study on a Valley Fever vaccine trial in dogs and a veterinarian. Co-author Mark Orbach's background is completely different.
I'm a fungal geneticist, molecular biologist.
Orbach is not the kind of scientist you'd typically turn to for this type of research, but in this case, his expertise was exactly what Valley Fever researchers needed.
We were interested in what are the genes in fungi that make them pathogens, so what allow them to cause disease in host.
Orbach and his lab isolated the gene they thought made the valley fever fungus infectious and removed it. To test their theory, they exposed lab mice to their edited version of the fungus. Schubitz says without that gene, the fungus didn't make the mice sick.
So the next question was, well, it doesn't make them sick. Does it vaccinate them?
Researchers used the edited fungus to vaccinate a group of dogs. Then they exposed the dogs to real valley fever spores. When they looked at those dogs' lungs, they had no clinically significant signs of infection.
None of the dogs were sick. In other words, no one would have taken that dog to the vet.
After two doses, Orbach says the vaccine was even more effective than researchers thought possible.
It was really exciting when we got the first results, and pretty much beyond anything that we could expect because it was better than anything that had been tried.
The first of its kind fungal vaccine is harder to preserve than viral vaccines. So now researchers are looking for a way to give the doses a longer shelf life. But they're optimistic they could have their vaccine in veterinary offices by 2023. It would be a huge step toward protecting Arizona dogs. But Galgiani says it's exciting for another reason.
It just looks like this vaccine really works really well. And for me as a physician, it adds that much more pretty powerful evidence that we should be able to do the same thing for humans.
Nearly 10,000 Arizonans have been infected with valley fever this year. A human vaccine wouldn't be that different from a veterinary vaccine, but Galgiani says the big difference would be cost.
The veterinary vaccine is probably fully funded, but we don't have yet the funding for the human campaign.
He says development of the veterinary vaccine cost about $15 million. Human clinical trials could cost 10 times that. A bipartisan group of lawmakers from Arizona and California have introduced a congressional bill to fund fungal vaccine research. Galgiani hopes lawmakers, even outside the Southwest, will see the value of that investment.
This is a biohazard we live in. You know, it's a very small part of the country, but it's ours.
Galgiani says even if a human vaccine is still years away, it's more within reach now than ever before. For Here and Now, I'm Catherine Davis-Young in Phoenix.
And you know, I just had someone very close to me here in Phoenix who just got diagnosed with valley fever and pneumonia, so it's serious and scary. Something else to keep in mind for everyone else, sometimes visitors to Arizona or the Southwest will get sick with valley fever only weeks after they've returned home. And doctors in different states often don't think about testing for the disease because it's not on their radar. So it can be difficult to diagnose. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Callum Borchers in Boston. It's Here and Now.